Today we're going to turn from looking at the genocide, as we've been doing for the past several years, and we're going to look at the administration of Donald J. Trump. We're going to start with a description of the ballroom and a sudden change in the trajectory of the ballroom as a judge orders construction on it to be halted. We're going to follow that with some of the core elements of Jack Smith's testimony to Congress on the 22nd of January. And then we'll hear Mark Carney's speech before the World Economic Forum about middle powers navigating a rapidly changing world. And finally, we will hear a piece by Robert Kagan and Carol Cadwalader concerning Europe's view of Trump's administration. So first, Laura M. Whitfield, MD, talking about the ballroom.
This is the visual that defines a collapsing presidency. If you walk past 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue this morning, you won't see the stately symbol of American democracy. You will see a disaster zone. You will see a massive mud-filled crater where the historic East Wing used to stand. You will see silent yellow cranes towering over the executive mansion like vultures. And for the first time in 6 months, you will hear something terrifyingly quiet, silence. As of 8 a.m. this morning, Monday, January 26th, 2026, all construction on President Trump's controversial $400 million grand ballroom has been ordered to an immediate, indefinite halt. The ballroom from hell, as preservationists have called it, is dead in the water. A federal judge, an appointee of Ronald Reagan, no less, has just issued a blistering 40-page injunction that doesn't just stop the work. It accuses the administration of willful deception, statutory vandalism, and gross fiscal negligence. President Trump, already reeling from the Davos disaster, the Japan bond crash, and the seizure of his New York properties, has just been blindsided in his own backyard. He woke up this morning expecting to see concrete being poured for his monument. Instead, he woke up to a federal marshal taping a cease and desist order to the White House construction fence. The official reason? The money is gone. The private donations that were supposed to fund this massive vanity project have evaporated in the wake of the Japan financial crisis. And without the cash, the judge has ruled that the president of the United States is effectively squatting on public land, destroying national heritage with an unfunded mandate. In this deep dive special report, we are going to walk you through the stunning court order that just dropped. We are going to show you how the East Wing demolition has turned into a political suicide pact. We are going to expose the phantom donors who fled the moment the markets cracked. And we are going to explain why this stopped construction site is the perfect metaphor for a second term that has completely run out of road. The king wanted a castle. He ended up with a hole in the ground. To understand the severity of this ruling and why Washington is in a state of absolute shock this morning, we have to rewind to late 2025. Fresh off his inauguration, President Trump announced the most ambitious and destructive renovation in White House history. He argued that the traditional East Room was too small, too ugly, and embarrassing for hosting world leaders. He famously called the existing facilities third world in a leaked memo to his chief of staff. His solution was the Grand Ballroom, a proposed 90,000 square foot extension that would rival the palaces of Europe. He wanted gold leaf detailing. He wanted 30-foot ceilings. He wanted a dedicated victory balcony facing the Treasury Department. The price tag was astronomical, $400 million. But he had a plan to sell it to the public. He promised the taxpayers wouldn't pay a dime. He claimed that a coalition of private patriots, billionaire donors, had already pledged the full amount. He called it a gift to the nation. The cost, however, wasn't just financial, it was historical. To build this monstrosity, the administration argued they needed to demolish the existing East Wing. This meant the destruction of the family theater, the dismantling of the First Lady's offices, and the excavation of the historic gardens. Preservationists screamed. The National Trust for Historic Preservation sued immediately. They argued, you cannot tear down a UNESCO-adjacent site just because you want a bigger dance floor. They argued that the White House belongs to the people, not the temporary occupant. But Trump bulldozed them, literally. In December, his Department of Justice utilized a loophole. They argued that the project was a matter of national security, claiming the new structure would include a secure, state-of-the-art underground bunker to replace the aging PEOC, Presidential Emergency Operations Center. Judge Richard Leon, the federal judge overseeing the initial challenge, was skeptical. But faced with the national security card, he allowed the demolition to proceed under strict conditions. The East Wing came down in weeks. It was a shocking sight, wrecking balls hitting the White House complex, dust covering the Rose Garden. It was visceral, but the deal was simple. You can dig the hole, but you cannot pour a single ounce of concrete for the new structure until the money is in the bank and the design is approved by the National Capital Planning Commission. Trump gambled. He tore it down, assuming the money and the permits would follow. He assumed he could bully the donors and the regulators. He assumed wrong. This morning, Judge Leon returned to the bench, and according to everyone in the courtroom, he was furious. We have the court transcript released minutes ago. It reads less like a legal opinion and more like an indictment of the entire administration. The judge slammed the Department of Justice lawyers for what he called a bait and switch of monumental proportions. Here is the core of the ruling. The administration admitted in a closed-door sealed filing on Friday night that the private funding for the ballroom is currently missing. The pledge of $400 million was based on non-binding commitments from major donors, hedge fund managers, real estate moguls, and casino tycoons, the usual suspects of the MAGA donor class. But remember what happened this week? The Japan bond crash, the asset seizure in New York, the Davos walkout. Those donors, they are currently facing margin calls. They are watching their portfolios bleed red ink. When the Treasury Department called to collect the actual cash for the ballroom fund on Friday, the donors ghosted. One major donor, reportedly a Las Vegas casino magnate who had pledged $50 million, formally withdrew his pledge on Saturday night, citing market volatility and fiduciary responsibility to shareholders. Judge Leon's ruling was brutal. He wrote, "The executive branch has demolished a historic federal structure on the promise of replacement funds that do not exist. This court will not allow the People's House to be turned into an abandoned construction site fueled by phantom capital and broken promises." He ordered an immediate stop work order. He ordered the General Services Administration, GSA, to provide a plan to restore the site, meaning fill in the hole if funding is not secured within 30 days. Think about the implications of that order. The president of the United States might be forced by a federal judge to fill in the hole he dug, leaving the White House smaller, uglier, and less functional than when he found it. He will be the president who destroyed the East Wing and left a patch of grass in its place. But the ruling gets worse. The national security excuse, the shield Trump used to start the demolition, fell apart in spectacular fashion. For months, the White House claimed this ballroom was necessary for continuity of government. They claimed the basement would house a new situation room that would be impenetrable. In today's hearing, the judge unsealed a classified report from the Secret Service that the administration tried to hide. It turns out the Secret Service opposed the project. The report states that the massive construction zone has created a critical security vulnerability on the east side of the complex. The open pit exposes the foundations of the residents to drone attacks, acoustic surveillance, and tunneling risks. The Secret Service explicitly stated that the design of the glass-walled ballroom was a nightmare to protect. They called it a sniper's paradise and a surveillance magnet. The judge caught the administration in a lie. They used national security as a pretext to bypass historic preservation laws, when in reality, the project hurt national security. This destroys the legal defense for the project. It means the ballroom is not a government necessity. It is a vanity project. And under the Antiquities Act and the National Historic Preservation Act, you cannot destroy national monuments for vanity. The media is already calling it the ballroom from hell because it has effectively trapped the president in a legal and political inferno. Let's talk about the optics. Politics is optics. And these optics are devastating. President Trump is a man obsessed with aesthetics. He builds gold towers. He wears perfect suits. He wants to project an image of absolute perfection and control. Instead, he is living in a construction site. The view from the residence window where he sleeps is a mud pit. It's piles of dirt, idle machinery, and orange safety fencing. The noise of the now silent machinery has been plaguing the West Wing for months. Staffers report that meetings in the Oval Office were constantly interrupted by the beeping of reversing trucks and the pounding of pile drivers. And now, with the work stopped, it becomes a monument to failure. Every time a foreign leader visits, they have to be driven past the Trump crater, When the Prime Minister of the UK visits next month, their motorcade will drive past a hole in the ground covered in blue tarps. Every news broadcast doing a stand-up on the North Lawn has the yellow cranes in the background. It is a constant, physical, undeniable reminder that the president started something he couldn't finish. Compare this to the great builder persona he campaigned on. I build things ahead of schedule and under budget. I will rebuild America. This project is behind schedule. It is over budget. It is unfunded. And now it is illegal. It connects perfectly to the asset seizure narrative we discussed yesterday. He can't pay for his building in New York. He can't pay for his ballroom in D.C. The theme is insolvency. Why did the donors really pull out? It wasn't just the stock market crash, though that provided the excuse. It was the toxic brand after the Davos disaster, where the president was openly laughed at by the world. Putting your name on a Trump ballroom became a liability. Imagine being the CEO of a Fortune 500 company or a major hedge fund. Do you want your name engraved in marble on a ballroom that is being sued by every preservation group in America? Do you want to be associated with an administration that is seizing private property in Greenland and getting its own property seized in New York? The prestige of the project turned into poison. The donors realized that this ballroom might never be finished. Or worse, the next president, who, according to the wipeout polls, is likely to be a Democrat, might tear it down the moment they take office. Nobody wants to pay $50 million for a building that gets demolished in 2029. It's a bad investment. So they used the Japan crash as an excuse to flee. They looked at the volatility, they looked at the subpoenas coming from the judge, and they decided to close their checkbooks. And Trump is left holding the bag, or rather holding the shovel. There is also a legal angle here for the donors. The judge hinted in his ruling that if the funds were promised but not delivered, the donors might be subject to fraud on the court investigations if they signed affidavits claiming the money was secure. The donors are lawyering up. They are distancing themselves from the White House at record speed. The Trump donor class is fracturing. The Democrats are already weaponizing this, and they aren't holding back. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries released a statement minutes after the ruling. He tore down the East Wing. He tore down the economy. He tore down our alliances. Now he stands in the mud of his own making. He is the demolition in chief. It is a powerful, visceral metaphor. The East Wing contained history. It contained the spirit of past first ladies, Jackie Kennedy, Nancy Reagan, Michelle Obama. By destroying it for a ballroom, Trump played into the barbarian stereotype. And by failing to rebuild it, he plays into the incompetent stereotype. The poll numbers from the wipeout survey are being updated as we speak. Independents are disgusted by the waste. Focus groups are saying things like, why is he building a $400 million ballroom when gas is $6 a gallon? He cares more about his parties than my grocery bill. The contrast between his luxury obsession and the voters' economic pain is lethal. It reinforces the let them eat cake narrative. And the Republican senators, they are quietly furious. They have to defend this. They have to go on TV and explain why the White House looks like a strip mine. Senator Mitt Romney, or his ideological successor in the Senate moderate wing, was quoted on background saying, "This is what happens when you govern by whim, not by law. We warned him not to touch the East Wing. Now we all look like vandals." There is talk of a Senate inquiry. The Senate Committee on Public Works might call the GSA administrator to testify. They want to know who authorized the demolition without the funds in the bank. If that hearing happens, it will be a televised disaster for the administration. So what happens next? The judge gave them 30 days. Find $400 million in cash or fill in the hole. Can Trump find the money? Maybe. He could try to divert funds from the military like he did with the border wall in his first term, but the judge anticipated that. The order specifically bars the use of appropriated funds without congressional approval. And with the wipeout looming, Congress isn't giving him a dime. He could try to get a foreign government to pay for it. The Saudi ballroom, imagine the scandal. A foreign power paying for an addition to the White House. It would be impeachable instantly. It violates the emoluments clause in the most direct way possible. So the most likely scenario is the most humiliating one. The GSA hires a contractor to pour dirt back into the hole. They plant some grass. They restore the exterior wall of the residence. And the Trump ballroom becomes a phantom limb of history. This is the nightmare scenario for a man who wants to leave a physical legacy. He wanted to leave a palace. He is leaving a patch of fresh sod where a historic building used to be. It is a symbol of a presidency that promised greatness and delivered destruction. let's contextualize what was lost. The East Wing wasn't just offices. It was built during World War II under FDR to hide the construction of the underground bunker, the PEOC. It has stood for over 80 years. It housed the First Lady's staff, the engine of soft power. It was the entrance for visitors. It was where the tours began. By tearing it down without a plan, Trump severed the social arm of the White House. Melania Trump, or the acting First Lady figure, has been reportedly homeless within the complex. Her staff is working out of a spare room in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, EEOB, across the street. They are separated from the residents. Reports suggest the First Lady is furious. The ballroom was supposed to be her legacy too, a place for her to host galas. Now it is her embarrassment. The internal friction this is causing in the East Wing versus West Wing dynamic is palpable. The National Trust for Historic Preservation is usually a quiet, polite organization. They hold galas. They save old post offices. For them to sue a sitting president is nuclear. They viewed this as an existential threat to the heritage of the United States. They argued that the White House is not the president's property. It belongs to the people. It is held in trust. Trump treated it like Mar-a-Lago North. He treated it like a tear down in Palm Beach. The judge's ruling solidifies a critical legal principle: stewardship, not ownership. This precedent will shackle Trump for the rest of his term. He won't be allowed to paint a wall without a permit now. The courts will be watching every renovation request with a microscope. Here is a detail the mainstream news missed. The construction crews on site, they belong to unions, the laborers, the crane operators, the cement pourers. When the Japan shock hit on Friday, the unions demanded assurance of payment. They know how Trump operates. They know his history of stiffing contractors in New York and Atlantic City. The contractor, likely a major firm like Turner or Gilbane, couldn't give that assurance because the donor money froze. The unions walked off the job before the judge's order. The judge just ratified what the labor market already decided: no pay, no play. Trump, the self-proclaimed builder, lost the support of the builders. The image of union workers walking off a Trump job site is a powerful signal to the working class voters he relies on. The claim that the ballroom was for a new situation room was the most dangerous lie of all. The current situation room in the West Wing basement was just fully renovated in 2024. It is state of the art. It cost $50 million. Intelligence officials testified in closed session that moving the sit room to a glass-walled ballroom basement was insane. You don't put the most secure room in the world under a dance floor, one official said. You don't put it next to a catering kitchen. The judge saw this testimony. It was the smoking gun that proved the national security claim was a pretext. It proved the administration was willing to compromise actual security for the sake of a party venue. There is a terrifying legal thread here for the White House counsel. If the administration submitted affidavits to the court claiming the money was secured when it was actually just promised, that is potentially perjury. The judge has ordered the White House to produce the donor commitments by Wednesday. He wants to see the names. He wants to see the signatures.
If those documents show that the money was never truly there, that it was all smoke and mirrors, someone is going to jail. Not the president, but maybe the GSA administrator, maybe the campaign finance chair. This turns a construction dispute into a criminal fraud investigation. It opens a new front in the legal war, just as the ballroom front collapses. The ballroom from hell is the perfect capstone to this week of horrors. It started with a lie at Davos about Greenland. It continued with a financial crash in Tokyo. It hit home with a seizure in New York. And it ends with a hole in the ground in Washington. The structure of the Trump presidency is collapsing, just like the East Wing. The foundations, money, fear, image, competence, are gone. We are watching a president under siege in his own home, literally. He can't build, he can't borrow, he can't brag. The only thing he can do is rage at the mud outside his window. We will be monitoring the GSA filings closely. If they issue a remediation contract, aka the fill-in order, we will let you know immediately, because that will be the moment the Trump era officially runs out of concrete. The builder president has become the destroyer president, and the hole in the ground on Pennsylvania Avenue is the undeniable proof. Sarcastic subscribe, like, share.
And that was doctor, physician, Laura M. Whitfield. Next up is parts, core elements of Jack Smith's testimony to Congress on the 22nd of January.
You know, it was the Republicans who agreed to this hearing. They agreed that this should be in public and on television. And, you know, it's possible they're only watching right-wing pro-Trump news, and so they haven't heard much about what Jack Smith actually did in his investigation. They may not know much about who he actually is and how he speaks. I don't know why Republicans agreed to do this today, but I'm guessing they did not expect that Jack Smith would just spell it out like this so clearly. Spell it out. The evidence he found and the conclusions that he drew about the president's criminal behavior.
Did your investigation find that Donald Trump attempted to manufacture fraudulent state slates of presidential electors in 7 states that he lost?
Yes.
Did he pressure state officials to ignore true vote counts in those states?
Yes.
Did he spread lies and conspiracies to his followers to make them believe that the election had been illegally rigged against him?
Yes.
Did he pressure DOJ officials to stop the certification of the election?
He did.
Did he pressure his own vice president, Mike Pence, to stop the certification against the oath of office that he had sworn to the Constitution?
He did.
And when all of this didn't work, did he, Donald Trump, motivate and inspire an angry mob to the U.S. Capitol to stop the certification?
Our proof showed that he caused what happened on January 6th, that it was foreseeable, and that he exploited that violence.
Did Donald Trump know that his allegations of election fraud were lies when he spread them?
Our proof was that he did, and we intended to prove that at trial.
Mr. Smith, if your case had gone to trial, would the evidence from Georgia have helped prove that President Trump knowingly engaged in a criminal scheme to overturn the 2020 election?
Yes. After an investigation following the facts and the law, we believed we had proof beyond a reasonable doubt to prove those charges. Rather than accept his defeat in the 2020 election, President Trump engaged in a criminal scheme to overturn the results and prevent the lawful transfer of power. Our investigation developed proof beyond a reasonable doubt that President Trump engaged in criminal activity. We followed the facts and we followed the law. Where that led us was to an indictment of an unprecedented criminal scheme to block the peaceful transfer of power. But you are correct that the only person charged in this case was Donald Trump, who, in my estimation, was the person most culpable for the crimes charged.
And that was Jack Smith's testimony to Congress on the 22nd of January. Coming up next, Mark Carney's speech to the World Economic Forum on the middle powers and how they're navigating a rapidly changing world. This was delivered on the 20th of January of 2026.
And a duty to be with you tonight in this pivotal moment that Canada and the world are going through. Today I will talk about a rupture in the world order, the end of a pleasant fiction and the beginning of a harsh reality where geopolitics, where the large main power geopolitics is submitted to no limits, no constraints. On the other hand, I would like to tell you that the other countries, especially intermediate powers like Canada, are not powerless. They have the capacity to build a new order that encompasses our values, such as respect for human rights, sustainable development, solidarity, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of the various states. The power of the less power starts with honesty.
It seems that every day we're reminded that we live in an era of great power rivalry, that the rules-based order is fading, that the strong can do what they can and the weak must suffer what they must. And this aphorism of Thucydides is presented as inevitable, as the natural logic of international relations reasserting itself. And faced with this logic, there is a strong tendency for countries to go along to get along, to accommodate, to avoid trouble, to hope that compliance will buy safety. Well, it won't. So what are our options? In 1978, the Czech dissident Václav Havel, later president, wrote an essay called The Power of the Powerless. And in it, he asked a simple question: how did the communist system sustain itself? And his answer began with a greengrocer. Every morning, the shopkeeper places a sign in his window: workers of the world unite. He doesn't believe it. No one does. But he places the sign anyway to avoid trouble, to signal compliance, to get along. And because every shopkeeper on every street does the same, the system persists. Not through violence alone, but through the participation of ordinary people in rituals they privately know to be false. Havel called this living within a lie. The system's power comes not from its truth, but from everyone's willingness to perform as if it were true. And its fragility comes from the same source. When even one person stops performing, when the greengrocer removes his sign, the illusion begins to crack. Friends, it is time for companies and countries to take their signs down. For decades, countries like Canada prospered under what we called the rules-based international order. We joined its institutions, we praised its principles, we benefited from its predictability. And because of that, we could pursue values-based foreign policies under its protection. We knew the story of the international rules-based order was partially false, that the strongest would exempt themselves when convenient, that trade rules were enforced asymmetrically. And we knew that international law applied with varying rigor depending on the identity of the accused or the victim. This fiction was useful, and American hegemony in particular helped provide public goods, open sea lanes, a stable financial system, collective security, and support for frameworks for resolving disputes. So we placed the sign in the window. We participated in the rituals, and we largely avoided calling out the gaps between rhetoric and reality. This bargain no longer works. Let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition. Over the past two decades, a series of crises in finance, health, energy, and geopolitics have laid bare the risks of extreme global integration. But more recently, great powers have begun using economic integration as weapons. Tariffs as leverage, financial infrastructure as coercion, supply chains as vulnerabilities to be exploited. You cannot live within the lie of mutual benefit through integration when integration becomes the source of your subordination. The multilateral institutions on which the middle powers have relied, the WTO, the UN, the COP, the architecture, the very architecture of collective problem solving are under threat. And as a result, many countries are drawing the same conclusions, that they must develop greater strategic autonomy in energy, food, critical minerals, in finance, and supply chains. And this impulse is understandable. A country that can't feed itself, fuel itself, or defend itself has few options. When the rules no longer protect you, you must protect yourself. But let's be clear-eyed about where this leads. A world of fortresses will be poorer, more fragile, and less sustainable. And there's another truth. If great powers abandon even the pretense of rules and values for the unhindered pursuit of their power and interests, the gains from transactionalism will become harder to replicate. Hegemons cannot continually monetize their relationships. Allies will diversify to hedge against uncertainty. They'll buy insurance, increase options, in order to rebuild sovereignty. Sovereignty that was once grounded in rules but will increasingly be anchored in the ability to withstand pressure. This room knows this is classic risk management. Risk management comes at a price. But that cost of strategic autonomy, of sovereignty, can also be shared. Collective investments in resilience are cheaper than everyone building their own fortresses. Shared standards reduce fragmentations. Complementarities are positive sum. And the question for middle powers like Canada is not whether to adapt to the new reality. We must. The question is whether we adapt by simply building higher walls or whether we can do something more ambitious. Now, Canada was amongst the first to hear the wake-up call, leading us to fundamentally shift our strategic posture. Canadians know that our old comfortable assumptions that our geography and alliance memberships automatically conferred prosperity and security, that assumption is no longer valid. And our new approach rests on what Alexander Stubb, the President of Finland, has termed value-based realism. Or to put another way, we aim to be both principled and pragmatic. Principled in our commitment to fundamental values, sovereignty, territorial integrity, the prohibition of the use of force except when consistent with the UN Charter, and respect for human rights. And pragmatic in recognizing that progress is often incremental, that interests diverge, that not every partner will share all of our values. So we're engaging broadly, strategically, with open eyes. We actively take on the world as it is, not wait around for a world we wish to be. We are calibrating our relationships so their depth reflects our values. And we're prioritizing broad engagement to maximize our influence, given the fluidity of the world at the moment, the risks that this poses, and the stakes for what comes next. And we are no longer just relying on the strength of our values, but also the value of our strength. We are building that strength at home. Since my government took office, we have cut taxes on incomes, on capital gains and business investment. We have removed all federal barriers to interprovincial trade. We are fast-tracking $1 trillion of investments in energy, AI, critical minerals, new trade corridors and beyond. We're doubling our defense spending by the end of this decade, and we're doing so in ways that build our domestic industries. And we are rapidly diversifying abroad. We've agreed a comprehensive strategic partnership with the EU, including joining SAFE, the European Defense Procurement Arrangement. We have signed 12 other trade and security deals on 4 continents in 6 months. In the past few days, we've concluded new strategic partnerships with China and Qatar. We're negotiating free trade pacts with India, ASEAN, Thailand, Philippines, and Mercosur. We're doing something else. To help solve global problems, we're pursuing variable geometry. In other words, different coalitions for different issues based on common values and interests. So on Ukraine, we're a core member of the Coalition of the Willing and one of the largest per capita contributors to its defense and security. On Arctic sovereignty, we stand firmly with Greenland and Denmark and fully support their unique right to determine Greenland's future. Our commitment to NATO's Article 5 is unwavering. So we're working with our NATO allies, including the Nordic Baltic 8, to further secure the alliance's northern and western flanks, including through Canada's unprecedented investments in over-the-horizon radar, in submarines, in aircraft, and boots on the ground, boots on the ice. Canada strongly opposes tariffs over Greenland and calls for focused talks to achieve our shared objectives of security and prosperity in the Arctic. On plurilateral trade, we're championing efforts to build a bridge between the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the European Union, which would create a new trading bloc of 1.5 billion people. On critical minerals, we're forming buyers clubs anchored in the G7 so that the world can diversify away from concentrated supply. And on AI, we're cooperating with like-minded democracies to ensure that we won't ultimately be forced to choose between hegemons and hyperscalers. This is not naive multilateralism, nor is it relying on their institutions. It's building coalitions that work, issues by issue, with partners who share enough common ground to act together. In some cases, this will be the vast majority of nations. What it's doing is creating a dense web of connections across trade, investment, culture, on which we can draw for future challenges and opportunities. I argue the middle powers must act together, because if we're not at the table, we're on the menu. But I'd also say that great powers can afford for now to go it alone. They have the market size, the military capacity, and the leverage to dictate terms. Middle powers do not. But when we only negotiate bilaterally with a hegemon, we negotiate from weakness. We accept what's offered. We compete with each other to be the most accommodating. This is not sovereignty. It's the performance of sovereignty while accepting subordination. In a world of great power rivalry, the countries in between have a choice: compete with each other for favor, or to combine to create a third path with impact. We shouldn't allow the rise of hard power to blind us to the fact that the power of legitimacy, integrity, and rules will remain strong if we choose to wield them together. Which brings me back to Havel. What does it mean for middle powers to live the truth? Well, first, it means naming reality. Stop invoking rules-based international order as though it still functions as advertised. Call it what it is: a system of intensifying great power rivalry, where the most powerful pursue their interests using economic integration as coercion. It means acting consistently, applying the same standards to allies and rivals. When middle powers criticize economic intimidation from one direction but stay silent when it comes from another, we are keeping the sign in the window. It means building what we claim to believe in. Rather than waiting for the old order to be restored, it means creating institutions and agreements that function as described. And it means reducing the leverage that enables coercion. That's building a strong domestic economy. It should be every government's immediate priority. And diversification internationally is not just economic prudence. It's a material foundation for honest foreign policy, because countries earn the right to principled stands by reducing their vulnerability to retaliation. So Canada. Canada has what the world wants. We are an energy superpower. We hold vast reserves of critical minerals. We have the most educated population in the world. Our pension funds are amongst the world's largest and most sophisticated investors. In other words, we have capital, talent. We also have a government with immense fiscal capacity to act decisively. And we have the values to which many others aspire. Canada is a pluralistic society that works. Our public square is loud, diverse, and free. Canadians remain committed to sustainability. We are a stable and reliable partner in a world that is anything but. A partner that builds and values relationships for the long term. And we have something else. We have a recognition of what's happening and a determination to act accordingly. We understand that this rupture calls for more than adaptation. It calls for honesty about the world as it is. We are taking the sign out of the window. We know the old order is not coming back. We shouldn't mourn it. Nostalgia is not a strategy. But we believe that from the fracture, we can build something bigger, better, stronger, more just. This is the task of the middle powers. The countries that have the most to lose from a world of fortresses and the most to gain from genuine cooperation. The powerful have their power. But we have something too. The capacity to stop pretending, to name reality, to build our strength at home, and to act together. That is Canada's path. We choose it openly and confidently, and it is a path wide open to any country willing to take it with us. Thank you very much.
And that was Mark Carney, the PM of Canada. And next up is Zhao Jiakun, a Chinese foreign minister.
Already clarified our positions on Greenland multiple times. The international law based on the purposes and principles of the UN Charter is the foundation of the existing international order. It must be safeguarded. We urge the US side to stop using the so-called China threat to use as a pretext to gain selfish gains.
And that was an announcement by the Chinese Foreign Ministry of Zhao Jiakun. And finally, we will hear on Carol Cadwallader's show, speaking with Robert Kagan. Robert Kagan is a neoconservative, a leading neoconservative thinker.
Okay, yeah. So basically, Robert, I contacted you because it's such massive news, obviously, and your interview, which I listened to over the weekend, I listened to it twice, Robert, this New Yorker interview you did, and it just felt to me that it was the single thing that I'd listened to that I felt explained what was happening with sufficient gravitas and urgency and clarity. That, and I kind of wanted everybody to hear it. And okay. I particularly wanted people in Britain to hear it this week, because we are obviously in the midst of this crisis. And my perception is just that people haven't really taken in the gravity of the crisis as yet. And I felt it was the thing which really came across to me, which was this whole thing of like actually having the historical perspective is what we need at the moment to make the sense of what's happening. So I just wondered if you could sort of take it away from there. What is your kind of message for Britain and for Europe in terms of what we are facing this week and what we need to do?
Well, it's a major crisis for Europe, because I don't know how much Europeans have come to understand that it's over. I feel like people have been treating this like a bumpy marriage, and if only we do a little counseling and I make a compromise here and do that, then they can make it all work out. But it people really don't understand that the world we've known is gone and is not coming back anytime soon, because for one thing, Trump is a phenomenon. The people who support Trump are not going away, even when Trump goes away. And the message that I'm giving people in the United States is stop counting on the elections to save us, because I don't think Trump is going to allow a free and fair election in 2026, much less 2028. So for Europeans, they need to stop waiting for the America that they know to come back, because it isn't. And so I think it's just vitally important that Europe now, to the best of its ability, come together and really undertake what would be a dramatic strategic revolution. Europe needs to become self-sufficient in both military and economic terms. It needs to start understanding that it is faced by aggressive powers on both flanks. They face an aggressive Russia in the east, and they face an aggressive America run by a megalomaniac in the West. And so it's not about anymore the alliance. It's about Europe coming together, building the capability. This is not marginal. It's not like going from 2% to 2.5%. This is a real revolution. Europe has done this in the past. They've had to. And I just hope they can do it now. And speaking directly to the UK, if I may, it's extremely unfortunate the UK took itself out of Europe, because this is a moment when I think the UK historically would have a leadership role in this, but I'm not sure the UK has it in it anymore to really resist the United States. So it's going to be quite a challenge.
Robert, can you just explain your background and like how you've reached this analysis? Because this, you wrote this amazing piece back in 2016, before Trump had even won the nomination. You set it out very clearly how you thought that if Trump came to power, that would be the way that America embraced fascism. And this came from your sort of long-standing track record as a historian. Can you just explain that and why you saw that so clearly with Trump?
Well, Trump himself is a sort of unique phenomenon. He really is a megalomaniac in a way that we haven't seen even with our most powerful presidents. I mean, for him, it's all about domination. You know, people think that he's transactional. The only transaction he's interested in is one where he dominates you and you accept that he's dominating you. And we can see that in his tariff policy. So Trump is, to some extent, a remarkable character. But the forces that he has put himself in front of in the United States, and quite deliberately, when he ran first for office in 2011, his sole issue was the birther controversy about whether Barack Obama, our first black president, was actually an American. And in so doing, he signaled to a very old and very potent movement of basically white Christian supremacists. These were the people who ran the South in the 19th century and throughout much of right up until the civil rights movement. They've been bitter ever since. They used to talk about in the 50s, they talked about status anxiety, but we're basically talking about people who feel like they are the true Americans and all these immigrants and brown people and people of other religions have come in and now they have too many rights, and they basically want to restore the America that existed circa 1920 in the 20s at the height of the second Ku Klux Klan. And the people who are running all this, the Stephen Millers and Russell Vaughts, they are true believers in what they call post-liberalism, but is really anti-liberalism. They're not just opposed to like the left. They're opposed to the founders, the American founders' liberal government. And some of them are quite frank. The ideologists of this movement are quite frank in saying that they want to change that government that the founders created. And that's what's happening. And the vehicle is this power-hungry Donald Trump.
So the thing which I found so, you know, the thing that I've heard you say, Robert, which is different from what I hear other people say, much of the language around this is still being couched in this threat to democracy. Like, if we don't do X, then there is this threat. We may not have whatever. And what you're saying so clearly is it's already happened. Yep. Like, with this, like, they are already inside the house. And the militarization that we're seeing in Minneapolis, this is the kind of end times. Is that correct?
Yes. And I think people are not seeing clearly, although goodness knows, I feel like the administration has done everything except climb up on the roof of the White House and yell what they're going to do. I mean, Trump is already talking about how you don't really need these midterm elections. But more importantly, the model that they have now displayed to us in Minnesota is the model. They have deliberately sent ICE in a way to spark protests because of their behavior. They're deliberately provoking people into protesting so that they can then declare a national emergency and invoke the Insurrection Act so they can get the U.S. military directly involved in putting down protesters, and calling everybody who protests a domestic terrorist is the legal justification for that. Now imagine this on a national scale. Who's to say that during an election they don't flood some heavily Democratic area with ICE people, which provokes inevitably the protest and potentially even violence, which then justifies sending in the military under the Insurrection Act and seizing the ballot boxes, which is what Trump wanted to do in 2020. He's made no secret of his thoughts, at least. And I think we're now seeing the beginning of the implementation. And the other thing about Minneapolis is it's designed to desensitize everybody, get us used to the fact that this kind of thing is going to happen. And so I think we're at a very critical juncture, and people are not quite waking up to it in time, in my view.
And yeah, because that's the critical thing, because it doesn't feel to me like that has landed in America, that people are alarmed, they're scared. But it's still this sort of impossibility of processing something that is so massive. Is that your perception as well?
Yes. Now, the really bad news is I think that at least 40% of Americans are completely down with it. I think that they are willing to have a dictatorship if the people who are being oppressed are the right people. And I also think that the leaders of the Republicans in Congress, John Thune and Mike Johnson, they're perfectly willing to live in a dictatorship if it means holding their jobs. And they're certainly not going to risk their jobs to prevent the dictatorship. So it's not just Trump and then everybody not getting it. There are people who are down with it. Then there's a lot of people who are either unaware or indifferent, or they don't really see it, et cetera. So you're really talking about a minority of Americans who even can see clearly what's happening. And I don't know what it would take to change that and have a much broader part of the American public understand it. We're still in the case where if there were four Republican senators willing to stand up to this, I think they could still stop it. But since there's no prospect apparently of finding four Republican senators, I just don't know where it's, I don't know who is supposed to stop it. The courts are not going to stop it, put it that way.
So the messaging today from Keir Starmer is it's like it's still this, we're in a special relationship with the United States. They're fundamental to our security. We've got to talk it out. It's like, you know, it's still this, we're not going to get into a trade war. We want to, and just using, you know, it's not right what he's done. It feels to me like it's sort of, I think with your, you know, messaging ringing in my ears, it seems to be spectacularly underplaying what is happening here and what is required of us in this moment. And, you know, in the British press, it was like this whole, oh, the British government played a blinder because it put on this state visit and Trump loved the banquet. And so, you know what I mean? It's all, we managed to pull it out of the bag. What's your sort of take upon that? And what should we be interpreting of what's happening in this moment?
Well, again, this it's just been a faulty analysis to think that if you can flatter Trump enough and call him daddy, that means that he'll leave you alone. As we see, he's not leaving anybody alone. It's really just, in fact, with him, it's an invitation to come back and demand something else and push you around. So you can't buy anything in that way. Now, the reason that these nations of Europe and Britain are doing this is because the alternative is ghastly. I mean, the alternative is you have to understand that America is no longer an ally. You have to understand that there is no special relationship. I talk in this larger piece that I wrote for The Atlantic, which is about the end of the world order and how America set us up against the rest of the world, is that, you know, Europe risks becoming a collection of fiefdoms of the great empires of the world right now. They can, you know, some of them will be under Russia's thumb, some of them will be under America's thumb, maybe some of them will be influenced more by China. But I'm a little worried that Britain is already in that category. That I don't know that Britain has it at this point to remove itself from its American, you know, from being essentially an American protectorate. And I have such admiration for the British people, and there's been so many times in history when Britain itself has saved the world, not the United States, but I don't see signs of that Britain at this particular moment.
So, Robert, one of the things which most alarms me, because it's my kind of like, you know, special area of interest, is the British government has undertaken these massive deals with these US tech companies. This came out of that state visit. It includes 2 weeks ago, I think it was, Britain signed a £240 million deal to put Palantir in the middle of our armed forces, our Ministry of Defence. It just seems like total madness to have a Trump ally, like literally in our defence infrastructure. What's your take on that?
That you're right, that it's madness. But look, I mean, a lot of what Trump is able to do has been greased by the powerful tech companies and the billionaires in the U.S. who are who are, you know, only interested in making money. And, you know, this is, Americans are not the only ones who suffer from that problem. And, but this notion that you, again, the notion that you can buy the Americans off by, you know, making these kinds of deals is just wrong. And honestly, Palantir now is a very pernicious force in the United States. It's the, you know, it's the big keeper of the surveillance technology that ICE is using in America. And I shudder to think about using it in Britain too. But again, the European countries and the UK are going to have to realize that they now are out of the world that they think they've been in and that they think is still existing. That world is gone. And it's time to understand that it's going to be every country for himself now. Or Europe can show the kind of unity that it has occasionally shown in the past and rise to the occasion. I wish I were more optimistic.
Robert, can I just ask you, I know you've got to go, just like this one last question, which is the other thing which it frustrates me incredibly is it's been from 2016, actually before then, Nigel Farage and his far-right parties, there's been a succession of them in the UK, have very clearly aligned themselves with Trump. They've also been very pro-Russian, and they're still treated in this sort of like cozy British way. Have you got any advice for us in that we're just a couple of years ahead behind you in some respects now? You had Biden, you know, you had this, and now you've had Trump come back. What is your, in terms of like understanding these far right parties who are aligned with the Trump agenda, what is the thing that you can tell us about how we should be looking at this and what we should be doing?
Well, I'm not going to advise you on how to deal with your own politics, but I will just say all of us, I think, have not understood, which I feel like is the most basic thing, is that liberalism, which is to say freedom and the protection of individual rights, is at death's door right now. I don't know where, if America is not going to support individual rights and freedoms anymore, and is itself going to become a dictatorship, I don't know where liberalism will survive. The only place that I can see it surviving is in the UK and Europe, but people have to understand what the stakes are. It is like the 1930s again, even though there's no Hitler, in the sense that I really do believe liberalism is a fleeting moment in world history. I mean, that's, if you, as a historian, I can say we've been living through a unique period since 1945, and there is no guarantee that it lasts. And I just think people have been very slow to understand what the real stakes are. And the real stakes are freedom.
Robert, that's totally terrifying. It's totally terrifying.
Sorry.
But I sort of like, but also it feels, for me, it feels, I find it actually comforting to have somebody of your authority and credibility saying this stuff, because I feel I'm just not hearing it in the mainstream media enough.
Anyway, well, thank you. And I hope, you know, I'm hopeful that that people will begin to see it more clearly. And as the pieces fall into part, a lot of it is, once you have gotten yourself into the mode of understanding what's happening, then everything that occurs fits a pattern. Whereas if you're sort of still living in a previous world, when all these events happen, people are just puzzled, or they're like putting it in a, what's the motive here, et cetera. The motive is domination. And in Trump's case, it's domination in the United States and also global domination. I think the world is waking up to that now. And unfortunately, it's going to be very bad for the United States as well as for everybody else.
Mm. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Robert. Thank you so much for doing this. And I'll send you the results and we'll keep it up and everything. And
great.
You're a superstar. Thank you. Keep on.
Thank you.
Keep on telling us we need
it. Okay. You too. Okay. All right.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
And that was Carol Cadwalader speaking with Robert Kagan.